Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, on the Progressive Radio Network, exploring the cultures of consciousness. This morning was reading over the relatively new edition of The New Yorker, which has a profile of Earth and Fire from the Arrowhead Foundation and the Arrowhead website, who are old friends, and both my wife Jennifer and I were interviewed for the article. And while it certainly could have been worse, it definitely missed a lot of opportunities. It was kind of interesting to see. On the one hand, it's kind of remarkable to see a positive portrayal of the Arrowheads. That's our guest dogs barking in the background, by the way. So it's adding a little country color. It was great to see a profile of what was for many, many years, and to some degree still is, a very outsider website, even in the world of the sort of exploding world of psychedelic research and the sort of shift in public perceptions about drugs, cannabis, and also psychedelics. Arrowhead still maintains a bit of an outsider edge because, of course, it's the place you go to find out how to take the drugs you actually want to take, and also a place where you can read, you know, trip reports from teenagers about, you know, drinking DXM under, you know, sort of less than ideal psychedelic circumstances. And so it's got a greasy kid stuff vibe to it that keeps it rather unpalatable for the mainstream. And so the fact that there was a genuinely positive and sort of charming portrayal of Earth and Fire was a pleasant thing and a sign of the times. I mean, it's kind of remarkable that a mainstream upper middle brow organ of respectability like The New Yorker would include positive pictures of sort of psychedelic culture, as the more substantial Michael Pollan piece did a couple of months ago. That said, it was a little disappointing that some of the real issues about information, about psychedelics, about cognitive liberty, et cetera, were sort of skipped over. They didn't really emphasize the education angle, which is the most important thing about Arrowhead, which is that whatever your perspective on this subject, whether or not kids should be doing these things, what do we do about it, should we keep everything scheduled, should we open stuff up, whatever your stance is, most people would agree that information, having actual real information, is key for individuals and society to make decisions about that. Of course, that's not historically been the case. In the drug war is partly an information war, both to obfuscate reality with propaganda and ideology, and also to kind of keep information under wraps, because, of course, the less you know about certain substances, the less able you are to take them. So there is a kind of circular feedback loop of information and drug culture, which the Arrowhead folks are perfectly aware of, and which, unfortunately, the author decided not to, or the editors really decided not to shape. So what we wound up with was sort of a quirky, charming, somewhat superficial, classic New Yorker story. But nonetheless, I suggest everyone check it out, at least to see how the sort of mainstream is reformulating the underground, which is one of the dynamics we're experiencing right now. Is what is the underground? Does it even exist anymore, inside or outside of drug culture? There's a very strange sense in which things are all above ground. Things are all available. They're all on the internet. People know about stuff. Subculture is mainstream culture. It's all wrapped up, and which can be marvelous and confusing at the same time. Staying on our topic of psychoactive compounds and cognitive liberty, I'm very happy today that we'll be talking with Casey Hardison. I think I first encountered Casey through interviews with him. He's a Yank who went over to the UK in the early 2000s and was a chemist and began producing psychoactive substances that were controlled under UK law and through a variety of unfortunate circumstances, was apprehended by the forces of the government and spent 10 years in jail in the UK. And though he had another 10 years to go on his sentence for manufacture and possession, and I guess one of exportation, which is how they popped him in the first place, they let him go, which is very nice. He can't ever go back, which is sad, but much less sad than spending another 10 years in prison. And so he's back here, enjoying life and occasionally writing wonderful pieces for Arrowhead. Casey very much, to my mind, represents, let's say, a kind of Arrowhead perspective on drug culture and drug experience, as sort of, you know, somewhat contrasted with some of the other ways that people are thinking and talking and taking psychoactives these days, and whether in terms of medical healing, or whether in terms of searching out the mysteries of the ayahuasca forest land. Casey remains someone I identify very much with the idea of cognitive liberty, which we'll be talking about more in this program. So, with no further ado, Casey, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Well, thank you very much. I'm a pleasure to be here, enjoying this very much.
Yeah. No, it's good. So I know you're in the midst of a move, so there's a lot of turbulence and change. I suspect the turbulence and change is much preferable to the monotony of prison. But I suspect, knowing you a bit and your verve, your energy, and your kind of tireless authenticity, that you actually made a pretty good run of prison, given all the constraints and frustrations involved. So, I would like to talk a little bit about your experience there and how you brought, you know, at the point at which you were apprehended, you were already not just someone who was interested in psychoactive compounds and was, creating them, being a chemist and, providing material and thinking this is a good thing, a fun thing, maybe even something you can make money off, but you also had a very deep a sense of the value and purpose of personal psychoactive exploration and indeed our right to do so. So I'm kind of curious about how you brought your own sort of attitude, perspective into the prison environment, where you're dealing with all these different kinds of characters, many of whom are not exposed to that kind of those sorts of mind frames, and really just what it was like being Casey in that environment.
Well, I mean, I had I had been through an amazing number of life's experiences by the time I got arrested, having yet another one. When I got arrested, I knew right then I was being arrested. And, as soon as the guy walked up to me and said my name, I knew the game was up. And the process of acceptance and just going with the flow of this is the moment I'm in right now, being here now in this moment, started like immediately. I was, switched into that mindset. I was high at the time. I was on a little bit of LSD. I wasn't, I'd taken it way earlier in the morning. This was the evening by now. And so going into prison, I knew... one, I was going to get a chance to rest. I'd been running at a high pace for quite a long time, and I was going to get a chance to rest, and I was going to get a chance to, try to represent myself, represent the cause of cognitive liberty. It was like a pretty stoic and philosophical moment. It took a lot of, a number of days for it to really sink in that, fuck, I really am in prison now, and it's going to be a long time before I get out. Thankfully, David Luke, I believe, sent me a copy of Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, which was basically like, if you've got a reason to survive the experience of the concentration camps, you will find a way to do so. If you can invent a reason, create meaning for yourself, then you'll make it through. And so that was a really great thing to have, like within the first weeks the two, you know, I had completed that book by the second week of imprisonment, and that helped set a perspective that was like, you know, this guy has survived 7 years in a concentration camp. There's nothing that's going to happen in here that's going to even compare to that, and I should be just fine.
Well, I got a question. I've read your account of being arrested before, and you talk about how you sort of immediately accepted the situation.
Uh-oh.
You know, I imagine myself in situations like that, and like the first thing would be just this terrible denial and this attempt to like, no, there's got to be a way out. Oh my God, you're like total like kind of an anxiety freak out. Maybe not. Maybe I would show up with that kind of radical acceptance. Is that just your personality, or do you think that that ability to jump on the experience, however disturbing, terrifying, with open eyes and open arms, is something that you also had already developed because of your experiences?
Yeah, I don't want to say it's my personality, like there's some sort of set personality or anything like that, but it's certainly something I learned and habituated to over a long period of time. Psychedelics helped. Growing up in the rooms of AA, with my dad being sober and talking about all that stuff that the AA people talked about, you know, with acceptance being very key. Seeing my father in the midst of very dynamic situations, being able to just accept this is what's so, and now we must pick up the pieces from this point and move forward. Seeing him as a role model was fantastically helpful. But I think radical acceptance was the order of the day. I mean, it was a situation of this is what's happening, be here now, and, you know, pay attention and be mindful of everything you say, every action you make, or I make, everything I say, or every action I make. And, this is it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and another thing is that you decided to represent yourself and to go what you could call the high road. You know, most legal cases, most drug cases that I'm familiar with where people get off what is this? Do you hear this, Casey?
What?
Oh,
I'm hearing you.
Yeah. I just had a sonic attack from my web browser. Those little sneaky advertisements that hide there. That you decided to represent yourself and also to take the high road of arguing your case based on human rights rather than trying to find some, you know, sneaky little error that the cops performed in order to get off on a technicality, which is most of the way that people would approach these situations. The, you know, hardened snaky defense attorney who finds the one little element of ambiguity and then sort of drives that home until the thing kind of falls apart. That was also a big decision. Was that always clear to you that you were like, hey, I'm in this situation, I'm going to go the high road and try to make an actual legal point, a philosophical point, a human rights argument from the situation?
That was from the get-go, that was clear to me. I knew, I knew Richard Glenn Boyer and his Center for Cognitive Liberty and Ethics, and had read every journal of cognitive liberties that had existed. And I just knew full square that I was going to, you know, I was hand in the cookie jar. There was no way I was going to get out of this. England doesn't have the doctrine of the poison tree. So it's totally at the judge's discretion. If he thinks the case is severe enough, it doesn't matter if the cops screwed up. They're still going to get you. The principled stand, the philosophical stand, was, you know, I knew I was going to do. My father had been a fierce constitutionalist freeman throughout my life and had raised me to understand law and to apply it, use it. And I knew I was going to do that. I mean,
did your father consider himself?
What else?
Yeah.
Say again? What else could I have done?
What else are you going to do? No, but was your father, was he a libertarian?
Yeah, I was a libertarian in probably the Jeffersonian sense of libertarian. Put that with John Stuart Mill, that our liberties are going to be protected by the black letters of the law. and the barrel of a gun. That's probably my dad's most poignant version of it. You know, it's going to be
it's one of those, it's kind of the old school libertarianism that we have so little of today in America. One of my, you know, many sadnesses about our contemporary political world is that the aspects of that libertarian idea, particularly surrounding the Bill of Rights, has sort of declined drastically in the face of a kind of corporate libertarianism and a sort of hysterical love of high-powered weaponry and the ideological basis of what it really means to be free, and the idea that that government exists partly to enshrine those freedoms. Somehow it got lost along the way. I'm not really sure how that happened. But it makes sense that you were ready to take a kind of cognitive liberty stance. What was your argument before the court?
My argument was pretty simple. It was I should have a right to alter my thinking as I see fit and help others do that in a way that's from a quality produced product and to where they don't have to get it from, you know, the streets, the black market. They can just come to me. I'm a nice, peaceful, loving individual, and they can come get it from me. But the main principle was that I should have the right to alter my mental functioning as I see fit, particularly if the state is going to extend that right to alcohol and tobacco users, producers and suppliers. And if they're going to extend that right to alcohol and tobacco users, then they ought to afford me equal rights. So it becomes a common law argument about the right to be treated as others are treated, and also the right to be distinguished from those causing harm in the same way that they distinguish, you know, alcohol and tobacco users, producers, suppliers that don't cause harm. But still, the whole basis is on, you know, that very simple, without the right to think, all other freedoms are meaningless.
Right, and how did they take that?
Well, I mean, they listened to me. Number one, they let me go. They gave me a lot of latitude. The judge, Anthony Niblett, gave me a lot of latitude in speaking my point, my position. At the end of the day, he very cursorily dismissed it and didn't address the arguments very well at all, and. So in the end of the day, I got really nowhere, except became a psychedelic folk hero of sorts.
Well, and you also got that argument out there. I mean, there's been, that is a coherent legal argument to whatever degree. I mean, I'm not a lawyer; I can't judge it in that sense. But in the sense that you're arguing from rights, there's a rights argument here. Have other people employed that kind of approach? I mean, I know you were working with Charlotte Walsh.
Yeah, not nobody before me, but right. A couple of people after, and they've achieved about similar results. They've made a little bit more headway in getting some analysis, some actual conversation about it in the courtroom as in on paper. But not much leeway has been made at all. Not much headway has been made at all. When I came up with that argument and started applying it, I thought that it was a pretty damn good dead cert, because I looked at the terrorism cases in the United Kingdom about indefinite detention, and when they came to the equal rights issue about indefinite detention, they cited a U.S. case, Railway Agency versus New York, which talks about not letting judges apply the law or the legislature apply the law to people they don't like, because they, I should probably find the actual quote. It's certainly in my court documents, but the basics is like, applying the law rationally, where there are distinctions, make them. Where there are distinctions, don't work, or they're illogical, don't make irrational law. Don't make laws that apply unequally. And the idea that's expressed in that case is that they would, by making unequal laws, they avoid retribution from, say, alcohol and tobacco users, who would be really upset if their drugs of choice were prohibited. So they apply it unequally because they're just way outnumbered in the alcohol and tobacco users. Go ahead.
You know, I was going to say it's a good example of how facts on the ground sort of constrain the rationality of law and the way that the legal system kind of sort of both acknowledges and doesn't acknowledge those facts on the ground. I mean, that being perhaps the most glaring one in any discussion of drug laws and drug prohibition in relationship to alcohol and tobacco, but also in terms of prescription pharmaceuticals. You know, that we get all this stuff about these dangerous illegal drugs when, at least in the United States, clearly the most out of control drug problem that we have right now, or at least in terms of growing numbers of it, are these addictions to pharmaceutical opiates, and then they get off those, and then heroin's cheaper, and so then you have all this exploding heroin usage in poor areas, et cetera, et cetera. It's an old story in some ways, but it is one where if you look at it rationally, it actually doesn't really make sense. And so the whole thing is kind of built on a bit of a house of cards, but it seems like it's a pretty stable house of cards. I mean, do you have much hope or actually even interest in pursuing or keeping this kind of argument alive, at least in a legal sense?
Well, I definitely have hope of keeping this argument alive in a legal sense. I think it will come around. I mean, it's something that will be recognized in time. I think I was just way too early. There's something in judicial circles called the ripeness doctrine, and I don't think it was ripe for the mindset. Like right now, we're in the United States of America, we have lots of states that are regulating now a lawful market in cannabis products. And I say it very clearly like that because you cannot legalize a drug by any stretch of the imagination. No drug can be made unlawful as well, because the drug itself is not the actor that will obey. What you can do is regulate actors such as myself in the exercise of property rights with drugs. And that's how the law actually works. It's like they're not regulating drugs at all. They're regulating humans. And so I, in particular, want to pursue that point right there, this whole thing about legalization. I am against legalization. I am against the concepts that are involved in legalization. I am not interested in that because we wind up with what the New Yorker did, is they co-opt the conversation and they make it, the media, turns dissent around and, makes it something that's fashionable for Lindsay Lohan or someone like it to get involved in. And
what's the connection between I want to spend a little more time with this because I think it's a really key point. What's wrong conceptually with the idea of legalization and how the error in that way of thinking leads to other problems?
The simple problem is very simple. So if we're talking about legalizing drugs, we're not thinking about the rights of human beings. We're thinking about the drugs. Oh, yes, let's legalize marijuana. Well, where in there is a conversation about I should have the right to alter my mental functioning as I see fit? That conversation is missing in the legalization argument. Where in there is the conversation of I should have the same rights as alcohol and tobacco producers, users, and suppliers? It gets lost. It gets lost in this idea that you can legalize a plant, which what you're actually doing is legalizing human action, making it lawful for humans to act. And that's what gets lost in there. And I think when people think the object of control is the drug and not the human, then it's a sleight of hand trick that distracts us from what's really going on.
I've thought about this a lot. I'm going to lay out a little concept here. I'd love to hear your response. So at the Last Horizons conference, I saw a talk by Stephanie Jones, and she was poo-pooing the idea that psychedelics are going to follow along the shifts in control over cannabis, you know, which is sort of in a kind of loose way, something I had been thinking. Other people were thinking like, well, the people are going to recognize that the sort of quasi psychedelic effects of cannabis are okay and they don't really destroy anything. So maybe in another cycle or two, a similar loosening will apply to psychedelics. And she said, no, that's not going to happen. And she laid out like percentages of people who had used cannabis and their changing political ideas versus percentages of people, even at the most, you know, like once in their life or something, who had used a psychedelic, and it was, you know, much, much smaller. And most everybody else, even people who use cannabis, are scared of psychedelics, or they just don't want to think about it. They don't want to deal with it. So that she was saying, look, that mass, the numbers aren't there. And then I was thinking like, okay, well, what else is going on here? And I went, well, I think in a way the shifts in cannabis regulation that we're seeing now is kind of becoming a missed opportunity, because as you're just perfectly along with what you were just saying, rather we're not really recognizing what is at stake in that shift in terms of our rights, in terms of a right to alter my consciousness, or even in terms of a right to pleasure, you know, to bring in Stuart Mill, absolutely, an old utilitarian argument. So it's like, so I should have my right to play, and that is actually kind of what's beneath some of this regulation, but no one is articulating it, either the proponents or the critics. Nobody's really talking that way. And if we don't take advantage of the changes in the cannabis market to make that argument where people are agreeing, like, I'm the cannabis user, I'm in a state where it's still you know, scheduled, I'm like, and then someone says like, yeah, man, you should have the right to enjoy yourself, and you should, and you enjoy yourself with this, you're not causing any harm, what's the problem? Absolutely. Like, yeah, that's right, you know. And but we don't see that in the discourse. We don't see that on the pro side and the negative side. It's always medical, or it's just some kind of, oh, we can make money off of it. I mean, it's a really very sort of disheartening point when a clear opportunity to underscore that aspect of American policy and even American culture, political culture, that is utilitarian and libertarian about pleasures and about personal freedoms, people don't even talk about it anymore. You know,
Jacob Solem, back in, I don't know, it was like 2002 or three, in an article in Salon called "Sane Yes," says that, you know, alcohol and tobacco people don't, or alcohol drinkers don't, you know, proclaim that their drink was endorsed by God and therefore that's acceptable to use. They just say that they like a nice glass of wine, and that principle of, you know, I get pleasure out of the use of psychedelic compounds is often not put forth authentically by people lobbying for transformations in drug law. I think, along with you, that it's going to take a while before other psychedelics are thought of in a category that it would be safe for most, you know, for it to be lawful to consume and produce and supply. I think it's going to be a while for that. I really pray, hope, you know, beg, believe that MAPS's work, Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, work with making MDMA a prescription medicine will transform the conversation in society to, you know, as the medical marijuana debate has done. It's like it's gone from the, you know, okay, it's a medicine and, you know, people are producing, are getting results from it, and, oh, I guess we'll allow it recreationally now, because so many people are using it. I think that conversation with the regulation of MDMA as a legitimate medicinal product will lead to, one, more people accepting it, and a greater public conversation, which I think would lead to MDMA being the first recreational, lawful, psychedelic compound, even though it's really more of a, what are you touching within? I'm trying to get back to that one. Intactogen.
A euphoric stimulant.
A euphoric stimulant. Here's a euphoric stimulant that I think might be the very first one that we would allow lawful recreational use of. I would like to see the 20, you know, David Nutt's, you know, 20 most popularly used drugs. I'd like to see each one of those go through a very large public conversation in which we discuss the risks and benefits, and we can take as a nation, as a world, as a state, we can take, you know, one molecule and say, okay, this year we're gonna make, you know, we're gonna allow this one, you know, say LSD, and if, you know, after a year we, you know, we can deal with the effects of public health and, you know, emergency expenditure. If we can deal with that and it works with taxation and regulation, then we'll try another drug. And that would be, I think that would be the most logical and, you know, authentic way of going about it, having a very large public conversation about it. Okay, we know we got it wrong before, but we need to proceed slowly, but we are going to proceed to a legal regulatory model, and here's how we're going to do it. I would love to see that happen. I've daydreamed about that at length.
Yeah, that does sound lovely. Well, we have to take a break right now. We'll be right back. We're talking with Casey Hardison on Expanding Mind, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. We're talking with Casey Hardison about all our PRN host just, oh, here we go, against legalization, Cognitive Liberty Org, Hacking Bay article. Yeah, I remember the days of the Journal of Cognitive Liberty were heady ones. That was one of the questions I had for you. When you went into prison, Cognitive Liberty was a big meme. It was something that a lot of people inside the psychedelic scene were talking about. It seemed to have legs as an actual workable idea that you try to employ in a legal sense, but even just as a general kind of conversational point of reference. And these days, you know, I don't hear so much about it. Again, I was at the Horizons conference, and I thought about this when I heard a presentation from Charlotte Walsh, who, of course, you know very well. And I was like, oh, God, I haven't heard this. Like, nobody else is using this language. Well, where did it go? And it's part of my, like, where did the cool libertarians go question. And so I put this question to you. What is it that's shifted in society, you know, inside, you know, the psychedelic culture, as if there is one, you know, there's multiple ones, but inside people who are interested in changing drug laws and in letting people have access to these substances, whether they consider them medicines or holy sacraments or a good time, something seems to have shifted. And I'm wondering if you have any ideas about that.
Well, I kind of do. I think I do. I'm going to try to formulate this. I haven't really put this into words yet, but I think what we've seen is a shift from the intense focus on what can we learn about our consciousness to how the fuck can we get high and really get off our tits and have a great time on the playa. I think that worldwide, the rise of the festival scene has given more hedonism, you know, more verve to hedonism and less to the genuine pursuit of understanding our consciousness and how it works. And the psychedelic community itself has lost a number of elders that were more concerned with how our mind works and how what these molecules can teach us about ourselves. And we've now got a lot more people that are a lot more interested in how to get off their tits, to say it in a nice English expression, to you know, how to just basically get high and have a good time. We saw that recent article about the microdosing that's been going around, how the business circles are really into microdosing now. And that's an article that's, you know, it's all about capitalism. It has nothing to say about the ecological movement, the fact that we're all one and that we have a global climate catastrophe that we're aware of as a result of psychedelics in general. It talks nothing about the political changes that psychedelics ushered in and got stomped on pretty hard. It's totally a co-opted article. It's basically like, yeah, take some acid and be more productive for your boss and make more money for the capitalists. And yeah, while that's an acceptable use, I don't think it's not got the same passion that I got into psychedelics, where I'm in this for the change, for humanity, for the planet, for everybody, for all of it.
Yeah, you know, you've said a lot there. Made me think about it. I mean, one on the point about partying, you might have seen this last year. Daniel Pinchbeck wrote a kind of, you know, public letter about why he wasn't going to Burning Man.
Yeah,
and
I really appreciate
while I don't always article. I don't agree with a lot of, you know, the way Pinchbeck phrases things, I respect the guy, but he has a very different take on a lot of stuff than I do. He had a great line in it, which is it really stayed with me. Is there's a big difference between mystical anarchism and hedonic libertarianism, and I really stayed with that because I was like, you know, that is the difference that makes a difference. Because from the outside, those two things can look very, very similar. And of course, Burning Man has always had the hedonic libertarian, you know, we're just going to go out here and party and have a good time, which I'm also, as I'm sure you are, you know, fine with to a degree. But in terms of a general conversation or a general sense about what we're doing, you know, hedonism is a powerful force. You know, it's like, you know, you throw in, you know, sexy stuff to Game of Thrones, it's going to be a better bad show. You know, it's just easier. Once things get hedonic, it's just a little easier to swallow for most people. They're like, yeah, this is fun. This is happening. This is real. You get that groovy club sense that something is really happening. But then there's these other opportunities that are lost, particularly ones that, you know, involve what we might call spirituality or psychological introspection or investigations to the meaning of the universe. But rather than those things happening inside of an obvious religion or, you know, Buddhist practice or a self-help weekend or whatever, those same things can happen in the environment of partying or the environment of exploring psychoactives. And so it's a very tricky line, and I think it's the massification, the sort of and the kind of festival culture itself. You know, it's funny with the festival culture, there's sort of this running battle too, because about the same in the same era that the festivals really started to blow up, you know, in the middle of the last decade, let's say, more and more people were also including these like speaker tents inside the festival. Yes, and you'd go to the speaker tents, and then there was sort of an attempt to keep, like, just for some of these people, it was kind of an attempt to keep these larger questions alive, but there was always a kind of irony about it too. Like it was hard to see where the purchase was really happening, especially because, again, part of the argument that, you know, I think both of us would agree with is that this is about pleasure. I enjoy that's all I need to say. I don't need to tell you that, like, that LSD is a medicine. I don't need to tell you that LSD is a sacrament. All I really need to say is that I enjoy it, and it doesn't seem to have done me any harm, and most people I know doesn't seem to do any harm. So the hedonic argument is a good argument, but it does seem that something has shifted in terms of the capacity of this strange subculture, or now set of subcultures, to keep alive some of these more probing philosophical and as you say, ecological issues too. I mean, I think in a way that's the big elephant in the room.
It's a gigantic elephant. I think there's a couple of places I'd like to go with what you just said. First off, to say no pun on purchase. The idea of going to something like Burning Man and purchasing a whole bunch of shit, including your drugs, taking a whole bunch of drugs, having a great time, and then leaving all your trash behind is so antithetical to the ecological movement, to the idea that we're going to that we can actually transform this planet and transform the way we use resources on this planet to live a sustainable existence. Leaving that for a moment, I just want to go back to the framers of the Constitution and the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, because you don't hear much call on that pursuit of happiness part. It is highly regulated. Even though it's put right up front next to the word liberty, our pursuit of happiness and in the world is now so tightly regulated with respect to drugs. I don't know, you know, it's regulated ineffectually, But the fact that people can get very large jail sentences, imprisoned for doing more, for doing no more than experiencing their mind, their own pleasure, and harming no one in the process, is one of the most absurd things I've ever heard about.
And yeah, I can't even really take those lines as seriously the way that I used to, because they seem ironic. You know, I don't want them to seem ironic. I want them to still seem, even despite all of the issues about slaveholding and this and that, I mean, you know, there's a lot of amazing, deep criticisms about the United States and the principles it was founded on. Yeah. Nonetheless, I did spend a lot of my life hearing those words in a way that I could sort of draw from as a kind of source and inspiration, and it's very hard to hear them now. In fact, even when you say pursuit of happiness, I just immediately see like pursuit of, you know, buying and selling, or pursuit of consumption, or pursuit of money as a.
It's my understanding principle. That it was originally, one of the original drafts was the pursuit of property. which brings back to another interesting thing that Jefferson said, is that government is instituted to protect property of every sort. My rights themselves are property that I own. My liberties, my right, the Bill of Rights, they are actually my property. They are actionable property at that. They are, if you look in Black's Law Dictionary under the definition of property, there'll be a lot of them, like 8 or 9 of them. And what you will find is that our rights, our liberties, are considered property of the person. And what we're doing with regulating production, supply, possession, import, export, we are regulating actions with property. And what government does is regulate actions with property, because that's what they do. And those with the most property have the most time to scream the loudest. And now we are run by the capitalists.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, that's really the key. I mean, again, it's... I think just looking at the way in which propertarian arguments, to my mind, have distorted some of what libertarianism could have been in America, and other, you know, tons of people would disagree and jump down my throat, either by saying that it was always a kind of crypto corporate, you know, money grab, or that things are just doing fine as they are, and that all of these great goods will come if we shift over towards a strictly propertarian and sort of transactional contract based reality. Nonetheless, I think it's pretty clear if you see the effects of a lot of that sort of thinking in terms of the larger social forces or effects. It's really the guys with the big cash wanting more and more. Cash wars. When I hear those words, pursuit of happiness, for me, it's like, it's almost more like how I can learn to be happy by dodging buying and selling. Like, how can I learn to be happy in a world where limitations are in our face, whether they're ecological limitations, the limitations of our system, the limitations of what money can give, or our, indeed even our ability to escape the money system. It's like, how can I possibly be happy by dodging that in whatever way I can?
Absolutely. I've learned, prison was really nice for learning to live with a lot less. For learning, you know, there are things that I may want, but, you know, my needs are pretty small. And that I don't have to participate to the extent, you know, I don't have to be in the rat race, though. I still have to pay my rent. You know, I didn't have to pay my rent for, you know, 9.27 years. It was quite nice.
What else did you do? I mean, you must have read a lot of books. Did you?
I subscribed to The New Scientist and The Economist, so I got one of them every week. Got 50 of those a year, basically. And then I got what's called the Times, the actual Times of London, not the New York Times or any of them. And I had a Daily Times, and I had a New Scientist and an Economist every week, and I studied a physics degree, and I did 7 years studying law. I played, I'm going to use my favorite English expression, shit tons of chess. I learned that one in there. I played so much chess, I can't even, I love chess. I absolutely love it still. I just made it my sanctuary. I turned it into my sanctuary. I made a really nice room for myself. I decorated my walls with, like, you know, inside covers or the covers of the maps bulletins or whatever nice pictures people would send me, that I could get away with it. It was a really comfortable living. I knew I was living better than two-thirds, if not three-quarters, or even, you know, 90% of the planet. I was living, you know, a very, you know, I had hot and cold running water. I had a toilet that flushed. I had a kettle I could boil water with. I had a television. I had my stereo, you know, a little boombox stereo I could use. You know, I was well off, but I was not free to move.
Right, right. And now you're back. You're back in the rat race. What are you doing now?
I'm not going to discuss it, particularly what I'm doing at the moment. I'm basically a scientific and technical consultant for a number of different people. That's what I'm basically doing now. I'm moving to Santa Cruz. I'm packing this house up. So that I could be more involved in the, not, you know, the MAPS community, the Bay Area psychedelic community, more involved in drug policy in general. That's where I'm moving towards, you know, emerging back in the world. I came out of prison. I spent 2.5 years out here in the woods. 2 years solid out here on the edge of the wilderness. I'm like a mile from the wilderness boundary, and I'm 20 something miles from Grand Teton National Park, and 50 miles from Yellowstone National Park. And you know, I was in Soldier Field for the Grateful Dead 50th anniversary with MAPS representing the clemency petition I put forward for nonviolent deadheads that are still in prison from the 90s. And I was standing there in the middle of that stadium with 80,000 people around it, 80,000 people in it. And there are more people in that stadium than there are within 100 miles of the house I'm sitting in right now. And, you know, it's just really nice. I came out here, I emptied my head out, let go of that prison experience, and now I'm ready to reemerge into the world. And so that's what I've been doing. But mostly what I do is I consult in various locations in the United States on cannabis chemistry and other versions of scientific and technical consulting.
Well, since you mentioned cannabis chemistry, I'm curious. Like, what are you most looking forward to in the explosion of technical, capitalist, cultural transformation that is going? You know, it's happening already, but it's going to happen in the cannabis world in the United States over the next 5 to 10 years. I mean, what part of it is the most like exciting and fascinating to you?
I think one of the most exciting and fascinating things about it is that it's happening at all, and that it's everywhere you look now. What I really want to see happen is I want to see, everything from whole plant extract, Simpson oil, all the way to the best of the. To the best of the shatter, to the the best of the products you can make. But beyond that, what I want to see is all of the terpenoids isolated on their own, each of them isolated on their own, each of the cannabinoids isolated on their own, and then proprietary blends developing that would allow an extraordinary large range of products so that I can find the one that I most like, basically.
Yeah, I mean... Well, here's a question on that score. I mean, basically, the idea is that there's tons of stuff going on in cannabis. It's an incredibly complicated entity with multiple alkaloids and the terpenes and the different cannabinoids, et cetera, et cetera. And so nobody really knows why this does that or this does that. And so one of the ideas, and you're describing it here, is we got to isolate them and then start making blends that would produce different kinds of effects. But I have another question for you, which is that in my experience, people react to, partly because of the complexity, people react to cannabis very differently, like the same, material will affect people in very, very different ways.
Yeah.
Do you think that there is, in some ways, can we really make a science of it to that degree?
Well, we can certainly make a science to where here I walk into a store and I can, because right now I can walk into a liquor store and I can buy, $1,000, 1,000 different versions of alcohol, right? So what I want to be able to do is walk into a store, a store, or, just order it online, however the hell it's going to work, say, okay, well, I want to try this percentage of THC, this percentage of CBD. I want to order this particular product that's known for this and with these particular terpenoids in it because these are the flavors I like best. And I want to use it for myself. And now I will, at this point, understand the subjective effects of cannabis on my own body and be habituating towards what I prefer. Other people will have to habituate towards what they prefer. The fact that it is very subjective comes back to mindset, comes back to, you know, understanding one's body, understanding the possible effects of the drugs, and knowing your dosage, and knowing your sources. You know, to get back to Irowid, know your body, know your mind, know your substance, know your dose, know your source. The fivefold version of that now.
The fivefold. That's
John Hanna added. John Hanna added the dose to that. Yeah. Know your dose.
Yeah, yeah. The as you said, it is kind of surprising. It is kind of remarkable. I mean, for you to, especially like you go into prison in one situation, you come out, and it's a different world. At least in the United States.
I'll tell you what. I can stand in California with a group of people smoking a joint, and every once in a while I still get the, oh shit, I'm in public smoking a joint. You know, I could get something could happen. It's not gonna. But I'm still somewhere in that mindset, still stuck in a time warp because I was gone for a decade. I didn't see it develop slowly. I didn't experience the development. So I'm just kind of thrust into it, you know.
Well, again, we just got a couple of minutes here. What do you think we could be doing now because this is happening, because it's the cat is out of the bag, it's clearly going to keep rolling. What could people be doing in order to bring some of these deeper issues, legal issues, philosophical issues to bear on the question of drugs as cannabis itself moves forward?
I think one of the things we could do most is to keep the conversation alive at the dinner table with our friends, with our family. You know, say something to the effect of, I enjoy cannabis. I particularly enjoy cannabis of these particular varieties. But also be, when you're speaking with people who are more naive about such things, put forth the memes about, being in a good setting, being in a good space in your mind. Titrating effectively. Don't just smoke a big fat joint because everybody else is doing it. Take a couple hits and leave it alone. It's much more powerful weed these days. Or get a lower potency weed for yourself. But discuss these things. Talk about it. And also, in addition to saying I like this, how can you argue with that? I like cannabis. Nobody's going to be able to argue with that. Bring in I like the way it transforms my mind. I like the way it opens, my creative process and the way I think. And, discuss the effects with your friends, with your family. And compare notes. See where there's room for you to utilize cannabis as a tool and not just just something you do all the time. When you're smoking it, think, okay, right now I'm going to, whip out some yoga, or I'm going to write something, a letter to a friend, use it as a tool occasionally. Remember that it is enjoyment and a tool.
Hey, those are, those are great words. Good point to wind up on. I just finally, you mentioned writing. I'm curious. I hope you continue to write. You've done some very interesting articles. We didn't really talk about them, but we've done interesting articles for Arrowhead. Are you planning any sort of more larger book projects?
Planning slowly. It's really hard, because I'm still kind of in it. Yeah. This whole conversation. It's hard for me to distance myself to actually get the perspective I think it would require for me to write effectively about my whole life. But it's coming. There's so many people who want it. And I just haven't done it. I just haven't taken the time yet to make it happen. But I see it coming soon, within the next year or two.
Good. Well, you got the time. Anyway, Casey, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Thanks so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. You have a good night. Good day.
All right. That was Casey Hardison, folks. Check him out. Go read his articles on Arrowhead. And he's got some great interviews out there. Next week, we'll be talking with Dave Mindell about autonomous robots. And with that, keep your minds open.